Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, that's right. We got a classic show with a fantastic guest. First time guest on the show, Hayden Pickering. Hey, Hayden, how you doing, man?
Hi-lo. Sorry, I messed that one up already. I was gonna say hi, and then I was gonna say hello. You know, when you do this same thing at the same. So I'm gonna go with hello.
Oh, good.
All right,
we'll take it. You know, third time's a charm. Really, no, but it's really wonderful to have you on the show, Hayden. He does all kinds of interesting things on the internet that you've probably seen. One of my favorites. It's hard to pick a favorite, really, but Hayden has a kind of what he calls a blog trying, or a design pattern library trying to be a blog, or a blog trying to be a pattern library. One or the other, but anyway, either way, it's called inclusive-components.design, which is a kind of a wonderful resource for looking at kind of common patterns and I guess how not to screw them up, things like tabs and cards and things like that, as well as like a really cool YouTube channel that you should be subscribed to called Making Future Interfaces that is like really high quality videos kind of explaining some ways that the web works these days. Anyway, there's more than that, but maybe I'll pass it off to you, Hayden. What's up, man? Tell us stuff.
Hey, Chris, and hey, Dave, and real pleasure to talk to you both. So I've actually written down a few like general notes of, so if a topic comes up, then I'll remember to say certain things about it. But one thing I didn't write down was anything to do with myself, and this is always something I do when I do a conference talk. I never do the section at the beginning where I talk about me because I always don't quite know what to say. And I also kind of like the idea of getting up, talking about something, usually something kind of random anyway, and then just leaving and people thinking, I wonder who that person was.
Sure. Well, you know what's weird about this show is that we're not an interview show anyway, really. I mean, sometimes it comes across that way because that's just, you know, we have a guest on, so I'd like people to know who they are. But our kind of our roots are just answering questions of people's, and it morphs over time, but we don't have like a pile of questions for this episode because there'll be enough stuff to talk about anyway. But you know, we're not really an interview show, but still, let's talk about you just for a minute. It'd be nice to hear what, like, you know, we even briefly talked about before the show that how everybody has a different way into this industry, and it sounds like yours is a little unique. I have no idea what it is.
Oh, yeah. So first of all, I suppose when I was very young, I wanted to be a stuntman, but then I quickly discovered that I didn't particularly like being punched or thrown out of helicopters. So I was conjectural. Obviously, I didn't like get thrown out of a helicopter and then think, no, this wasn't for me after all. I decided that I didn't want to try it. Basically, it's the feeling in your chest, you know, that kind of anxious feeling you get when you're flying downwards very, very quickly. So I gave up on that idea fairly early on. Only really made it to throw myself out of a couple of trees and slightly taller, like maybe two stories. And then moved quickly on from that. And I got into art and design. And I think a lot of people who get into music and they're very creative, and a lot of musicians, especially in the kind of the accessibility community, who they started out doing music and doing creative stuff and doing art stuff, and then moving more into technology and finding the web as a really great way of expressing their ideas and also like pointing people towards things they've done so that they can sell them. So I got into like digital art, I suppose, because I wanted to make like album covers and things like that. And I think I was using Corel Photo Paint, which I stuck to for a long time, despite the fact that Photoshop was the thing that everyone kind of wanted me to use, just because I was more used to it. It didn't have this sort of layer thing where you had to choose all the layers individually. You just basically move stuff around. If you clicked on something, it came to the forefront. So I kind of found that nice and simple to use. And I went to university and I studied something called digital media. And that was basically a cross between photography and other digital stuff. And I learned how to make a website in Dreamweaver. like an early version of Dreamweaver when it was still owned by Macromedia.
Sure, yeah.
And the website was a spoof of a British television show called Art Attack. So there's this children's television show called Art Attack, and there's a guy called Neil Buchanan. It was the late 80s, early 90s, so naturally he had a mullet.
What a great name, Art Attack.
Yeah, exactly. It's very aggressive, very in your face. And he, yeah, so he would do these art attacks where he'd go around and create these large artworks spontaneously out in the wild, you know, in a park or on the side of a building or something like that.
Gosh, how great. I've never heard of this. British show, actually, obviously. And the logo looks like Double Dare, Dave. Really, there's like splotchy.
Oh, did you find it?
Paint. Oh, yeah. Nice. I like to live Googling, of course. So you were into it, or did, yeah?
Oh, I mean, I guess at being a university age, I felt I was a little bit grown up for it by then. But I kind of like doing satirical and spoofy type things. So I did, my first website was a parody of Art Attack called Dart Attack. And the idea was that this guy, Neil Buchanan, would go around with a set of darts, like, you know, like you'd play darts in the pub, and throw them at people instead. So,
that sounds like a college project. Yeah, yeah. Like,
yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. And actually that got a better grade than some of the stuff which wasn't sort of violent or nonsensical. And so I never really understood that. But yeah, it was like a Dreamweaver thing, so it was made out of, you know, when you visually, you had like the table thing where you actually visually like pulled the sides of the cells around to make it kind of into the right shape. And then when you actually then viewed it in a browser, it all collapsed back in again, and it never really worked. It was that kind of thing. So just colored cells in those sort of primary colors that you saw in the logo.
Yeah.
And just darts everywhere, and with, you know, pictures of people with darts in their head and lots of blood and that kind of thing.
So that was like your first website, or at least a strong memory of an early website you made.
Yeah, I think that was either my first or a very early one. And then the other thing, you know, going back to the music thing, was that I would make websites just to kind of promote music that I'd done and say, you know, go and find it here or go and buy it here. And I got a reputation for being quite good at hacking MySpace pages. So some of my early paid work was actually kind of making MySpace pages look good somehow. And I learned a lot about HTML and CSS and the sort of dark arts of kind of pulling that stuff around when you don't actually have the code base to really, you know, kind of like the Zen Garden thing where you have the set HTML and then trying to make it do interesting things with CSS.
I think MySpace customization is maybe like that and Neopets. Like, you could kind of hack Neopets, right? Like, that is I think a lot of people have come into our industry via those two sort of hacking formats.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think you're alone.
Yeah, I think you either come from a formal background, I guess, didn't you? Like a computer science sort of background, or you're kind of a creative person who thinks, oh, the web sounds exciting, I can do things here, and then suddenly I've got an audience. And I think that's what draws people like me, is just, if I can learn this new-ish medium and with code and everything, then I can translate what I'm doing in my bedroom or whatever into having it somewhere where people around the world can view it. And that was just really exciting. And it's kind of, I know that you've covered this on this show before, and I really enjoyed listening to the conversation you had about it. But there is this sort of tension between the formal computer science-based kind of way of doing web stuff and the much more laissez-faire, creative, it's okay to hack things thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You had a post about this, kind of, right? Trying to remember the whole post from memory.
I certainly can't remember it, but
the gist was, you're through your consulting work, that's the kind of work you do, is that right? Consulting work, you kind of hop into companies and you like find out like no one like knows how to do the accessibility, and then everyone's kind of just like, overworked as like a full stack developer.
It was the problem with full stack thing. Yeah. I've had a lot of experience with this recently where you get these individuals who are just given all the code to do. And it's weird that we think of code in and of itself as being a profession. Like if you can write SQL or Squirrel or whatever you call it, then you'll be able to write CSS. But they're completely different tools. They both just happen to be digital tools which involve browsers and HTTP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like speaking Spanish and Chinese.
Absolutely. Like
there might be no crossover, but there's not much.
But it's even more divergent than that, I think, because at least Spanish and Chinese are both a means to a similar end, as in communicating the same kind of stuff. Whereas CSS is a despite the fact that you're writing code, it's the product is a visual thing to do with form and layout, and SQL is, I don't even really know what SQL is.
Well, I'm going to pretend stuffing data into spreadsheets, putting like stuffing text into spreadsheets.
It's Excel, isn't it? Yeah.
Basically. So I guess you've seen. Of course, that's a problem if somebody who's given a job can't do the job proficiently, right? Like that's, that could be any combination of jobs ever. You know, I don't go to my doctor and ask him to fix the sink or whatever, right? But the actual problem part comes in was nobody does that, the doctor sink thing, right? But the full stack thing does happen, and it happens a lot, and you're seeing it a lot. So that's where the problem part comes in.
Yeah,
absolutely. This Dr. Sink problem. It's a good...
Well, actually, that doctor analogy I've used in the past to try and basically convince people to listen to their designers. Like if a designer... And when I say designer, I mean very broadly, not someone who just does graphic design, but someone who does research and does interaction and does the accessibility end of things as well, and structure and whatever. But the idea of a doctor... the idea of going to a doctor and him saying, "Well, I'm diagnosing you with a sprained ankle," and then you saying to him, "Actually, I think I want to go more with diabetes," and him then sort of being like, "Oh, okay, fine, it's diabetes then." I mean, that's how we seem to communicate with this whole stakeholders and designers. That seems to be the relationship where ultimately designers capitulate, even if it's something really absurd, and trying to empower designers to be a bit more actually I know my job is kind of I think is important.
So but it's kind of interesting how this all dovetails into each other, because we got you're young, university-ish, and making parody art attack websites, clearly into art and music, and come to the web for various reasons to promote your music or and that type of thing. And then the Hayden of today is interesting, and that you have all this accessibility experience and write about that and consult about that and whatnot, and have websites that are clearly art focused, like your mutable.gallery, which is just look at art that I've made, you know? So there's like two sides of you, you know, there's still this, like, I'm just a hacker making art, whatever. And this, you know, accessibility person and this educator person.
And historically, like, art websites and music websites tend to be the least accessible. So I'd love to hear how you...
That's true. They win all the awards, don't they? But then you try and actually use them or even just load them on a reasonably sort of average network, and all hell breaks loose. Yeah.
So where did that part come from, though? Your desire to think accessibly and deal with accessibility, if that's not a natural transition from art and music, which maybe...
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I think I don't think they're as kind of like as disparate interests as they might seem, because with the accessibility thing, it was when I started to see how many mistakes we're making in terms of not taking into consideration, just broadly speaking, how differently people interact with websites and web applications. I suddenly, my job just became, overnight just became more interesting. Because up until that point, my concerns were really, I suppose I just thought about, does it look good? Is it easy to read? That kind of thing. But not the much broader kind of discipline of inclusive design and all of the different considerations that come into play. And so suddenly I was met with this thing where I thought, oh, actually, this needs to be rethought a lot. And that just means there's more for me to think about. There's more problems to solve. There's more opportunities for me to be creative. So quite selfishly, I delved into accessibility and into inclusive design because it made my life more interesting. Now, I know that it's obviously it's a good thing to do, and it's a good process to go through, and a good mindset to have when you're designing, to actually think about the people that you're making stuff for, which, you know, it seems ludicrous that people don't do that. But it was quite selfishly, it was just that it opened up opportunities to fix more things. And so I felt more useful in a way. I felt more validated. Like, oh,
that's kind of great. It shows a little bit about your personality, because if you can think of, oh, there's lots of different people that all use the web in different ways, and that your reaction to that is, how fun. Wow, yeah, yeah, this is exactly, a lot more interesting, where a lot of people are like, oh, shucks.
I do find it really weird that folks tend to go, oh no, but that's something extra for me to think about. And I think that's probably because they're really enamored with other parts of our discipline, or whatever you want to call it. I try not to call it an industry. I try not to think of it in terms of business. There's like web discipline, web community thing, stuff we do, whatever it is. And so there'll be people who don't want to think about that because they're really interested more in the kind of, I don't know, like the optimization-y side of things, and the how neat they can write their code, and the latest flavor of programming or whatever. And that's kind of what keeps them interested. But actually, that to me is that it's all a means to an end. So that doesn't, personally, it doesn't interest me that much. It's the point where the human meets the interface is what I find interesting, I guess. And so it was like a joy to think, oh, so there's so much here that I can now, there's so much more to fiddle around with and kind of calibrate to make it work better in different ways.
And then only to discover that that's a somewhat of a rare opinion to have. Maybe not. I rarely hear people argue against accessibility. You mostly hear about just people screwing it up or whatever, you know, like,
yeah,
most front end developers, including myself, are like, of course it's a good idea, and that yet are still guilty of screwing it up. So
everyone screws it up. I mean, I screw it up as well. And it's like anything else. The key skill to have is to be able to change your mind, or to accept that things are not as you presumed they would be. So when you encounter a situation where it's like, oh, actually, there's a lot of people who just wouldn't be able to use this because of the way it's designed, and we need to walk it back to a more kind of primitive version of itself, which is much simpler, or something like that, instead of just kind of going, do you know what? We've made it this way and we're excited about it. We're just going to plow ahead. Or, you know, just in any way, if there's any way that you can't accept that you've made mistakes. And I think generally speaking, this is where we go wrong as a species, is that it's not so much that we make mistakes. It's the fact that once we've made the mistakes, we pretend that they weren't mistakes. And then we carry on as we were. Brexit, you know, is a good example of that. So, yeah, it's I said I'd managed to shoehorn some Brexit stuff in, didn't I? But yeah, but it's this thing of,
it was part of your contract.
I see you resorted to clickbait recently to get some people over to.
Oh yeah. What was funny about that, and this, I mean, it says a little bit about, I guess, privilege, was that people clicked. So to explain, I did a blog post where I think it was Facebook Withdraws React, I think was the title of it. And then loads of people frantically clicked on it. And then I had a lot of people going, oh, okay, that's clever, nice one. Because what it was trying to get people to sign this petition to revoke Article 50, which is basically the whole Brexit thing, as it turns out, is a huge mess being handled really badly by an incompetent government, but also based on illegal and fantastical premises. Therefore, we should probably just call it off. And so the idea was that we were trying to get as many people to sign this petition, and it got out to over 6 million people signed this petition. But I got a lot of feedback from people where they were writing to me saying, oh, wow, okay, you really scared me there. I really thought that I couldn't use React anymore. And I was like, well, yeah, okay, that I'm happy for you, but my country is literally going to, we are going to be in plastic bags within the next 2 or 3 months. So, you know, like, priorities, I guess.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear about your framework. I'm sorry you're troubled about your framework, but I'm about to lose free travel across the year.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Discover.bot. Discover.bot is an online community for bot creators designed to serve as a platform-agnostic digital space for bot developers and enthusiasts of all skill levels to learn from one another, share their stories, and move the conversation forward together. Discover.bot was built by Amazon Registry Services, and it's an informational place for novices and experts in the bot development space. Discover.bot regularly publishes how-to guides and the latest bot building resources. Some recent guides are how to design a bot personality, how to set up payments through your bot, and how to stop shopping cart abandonment. Discover.bot also shares expert advice and provides insights on all things bots. For example, what KPIs are worth measuring, why emojis may be breaking your bot, and how to write an engaging chatbot dialogue. They cover all sorts of topics and genres, including bot development, bots for business, chatbot news. If you're new to the bot development space, Discover.bot will teach you everything there is to know about bots. There's a guide called Beginner's Guide to Bots, which will teach you how bots were invented, the basics of how bots work, what bots can do, and where bots are developed and published. And if you've already got a few bots of your own, Discover.bot can help you choose a framework that's aligned with your business. For example, e-commerce, travel, finance, hospitality, and more. They've got a great guide just for you called Guide to Bot Building Frameworks. From NLU features to platform connectors to APIs, there's a lot to consider. Find out what all the major frameworks have to offer so you can choose a chatbot framework that fits your objectives. To find out more, go to discover.bot/shoptalk so they'll know you came from us, and check out discover.bot. Our thanks to discover.bot for sponsoring Shop Talk Show.
It keeps nagging me. You said you call it a discipline, not an industry. Why? What is that? Is there?
I'm not sure if discipline is the right word, but I think of the web as just being like a public good, just a public service, and I think that the kind of professional developerization of it is a bit sad. I mean, I'm a professional developer or designer for the web or whatever you want to call it. So Sarah Vieira started doing this whole campaign, which is let's make the web again, and did this silly website with all of the GIFs and everything like that, which is fantastic. Got loads of attention, blew up like 2 different servers that she put it on because it was so popular. And I think people really are kind of bored with things getting kind of a bit sort of staid and a bit repetitive and a bit samey and just a bit sort of corporate, I suppose. And when I go to web conferences, I only accept invitations to conferences where I know they're kind of community conferences. So because I like to be around people who are just passionate about it, they're not in it to kind of, I mean, they're in it, they make money out of it, it's their living. But people who are just like, they want to make things for the web because it's fun and it's, you know, it's a chance to be creative. It's a chance to help people and to reach people. So conferences like Frontiers and Beyond Teller, and I think we should be having, it's almost like bringing to people together like in a church. I mean, I'm an atheist, but the idea of it being where people will come together in one place and they're just all good people in one place. I mean, you could do a lot of good together. As it turns out, we end up, you know, talking about the finer points of CSS or whatever, which is very specific technical concern. But when you get all of those people in that place, I've made, you know, strong friendships with people who I'm very aligned politically and culturally in different ways, because those conferences are places to as meetings of minds and passions, rather than just here is where we will learn stuff which will make us money. Whenever there's someone kind of businessy, for instance, on Twitter, I can sort of tell straight away, and I know I won't follow them, because I know that there's going to be a lot of self-promotion or promotion of certain. I mean, we all do that to some extent. We have to.
Yeah, sorry about that.
But no. I mean, I do it as well. Mm-hmm. And I
cover this in my book. $9.99.
Yeah. Well, do you know to level the balance, if you like, I can read you a negative review for my book, which was quite fun to receive. It is like histrionically amazing.
Is the book the book is inclusive components?
So the book's inclusive components, and it started off as a website, and the idea was that it was different. Each post was kind of recreating a different common kind of pattern or component that you'd get in your design system or on your website or whatever. So as Chris mentioned at the beginning, like a tab interface or a carousel or whatever. And so with the carousel one, I had a little joke at the beginning of the article. I'll just bring it up on the browser. It says, carousels or content sliders are like men. They are not literally all bad. Some are even helpful and considerate. But I don't trust anyone unwilling to acknowledge a glaring pattern of awfulness. Also, like men, I appreciate that many of you would rather just avoid dealing with carousels, but often don't have the choice, hence this article. So I thought, you know, that's kind of a fun way to introduce the article. It's kind of punchy or whatever. And I started getting complaints about this, but obviously these complaints were from men. And I don't know if they knew that I was a man. I think as a man, I'm kind of entitled to criticize men, but I don't think, especially since there's a kind of get out clause there, which says that not all men are bad. But I got an interesting, I won't say it was a review, it was more of a kind of DM from someone, and it's several paragraphs long. But towards the end, it says, look, I can't fix you, but I can forgive you. You've got to overcome your own demons. We've all got them. Just because you're male doesn't mean you're a dickhead. You don't have to act like the negative stereotype you've been fed by our society. Being a man means admitting to your mistakes and trying to make better. At least that's what I was taught when I was growing up. Anyway, I forgive you and I'm leaving now. Inclusive components is still pretty good, despite the one hateful joke. I hope one day you can shed off the hypocrisy and become as good a person as you aspire to be. Goodbye. So that's, I guess, okay. As a review. The thing is, if you take away all of the stuff about you're attacking me as a man or whatever, and you just get the bit about the book, it says inclusive components is pretty good. So I'm taking that as maybe, I don't know, 3.5 out of 5 or something like that, if that were a review. Yeah,
pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Like, you're hateful and I think that you are struggling with demons and and you're a hypocrite, etc. But on the other hand, and after all, it is about the book in the end. So, yeah, I'm pretty happy with that over, you know.
Solid review. Thanks. You know, sometimes it takes a while to get. It needs an editor, maybe, you know.
Yeah, it's a good reminder to never tell a joke on the internet.
You know? Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah, no, I have. Well, I mean, I talk about comments and things. There's another one. So I did an article on Medium. People always like complain that I'm writing stuff on Medium because it's sort of more ephemeral. And now they've started doing this thing where you can only read so many articles and then you have to sign in and pay something or something like that. Have I got that right? I think it's something they've made.
Yeah, it's a little unclear to me too. Like what the algorithm is that decides you're going to get the paywall is a little unclear. Yeah.
I'm not sure either. But in any case,
but every page gets like a hey, you like Medium?
Oh gosh, yeah.
Like
they even have like a dating analogy they use, isn't it? Like hey, let's make it official.
That sort of whimsical language that people use. It's like. When you haven't got an actual copy editor who knows when not to make sort of weird, creepy jokes, yeah. Actually, you've just reminded me. Have you ever seen the film Cool as Ice. It's a 1991 film, which is like a vehicle for Vanilla Ice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he rides a motorcycle around. I'm pretty sure I've seen it, but you know, it's not one of the standouts.
No,
it seems like it. Well,
I'm an 80s, like 90s kid, but I don't remember watching it the first time around. But I just watched it on Netflix because they did like a riff tracks version of it, you know, like where they talk over it and make jokes. But it was,
yeah.
So it was weird because I think cultural attitudes have changed so much for the better since then. But Vanilla Ice just played this kind of weird, toxic, masculine character. And he saw this girl that he fancied whilst driving a motorcycle. So she was on one side of this white fence and he was riding his motorcycle. She was going alongside on the horse. And of course, if you're near horses, you don't want to be like revving a motorcycle engine anyway, because it will scare them. But then to get her attention, he launched the motorcycle over the fence into the field next to her. The horse reared up and she fell off the horse. And then she said, "What the hell are you doing?" And then he said, "What the hell's your problem?" And then the rest of the film, he stalks her and steals her personal possessions. So, sorry, I'm not sure how this is relevant to what I was about to say. But in any case, that is it's a terrible, terrible film on so many different levels. Yes, I hope I never have the... never watch it again. Anyway, so making jokes on the internet, as you say, Dave, is a bad idea. I wrote an article on Medium. I put it on Medium because I wanted it to be ephemeral. I didn't want very many people to think of it as being sort of like canon for me. So it's called, what was it called? CSS, A New Kind of JavaScript. And then I...
Yes.
So then there were people who were, you know, most people kind of got the joke and thought it was kind of fun, but also kind of... you know, it was saying something maybe about the relationship between CSS and JavaScript and all of that kind of stuff. But then there were people who just thought that I thought that CSS was a type of JavaScript. And there was a comment, there was someone I wrote, CSS is a declarative subset of JavaScript, specifically as one of the statements. And this guy comes in and goes, "No, it isn't. It has nothing to do with JS at all and existed before web scripting languages were standardized." And I thought, okay, he hasn't got the joke, but if I'd like, I can kind of slowly maybe help the penny drop by sending him a few replies. So the next reply I wrote was, "I've been writing JavaScript since 1992, and I can assure you that CSS is a JavaScript API. So he wasn't buying that either. So his reply to that was, "Considering JS was invented in 95, I somewhat doubt that." So I thought, okay, I'm still not getting anywhere. I'm going to go for, you know, just... go for broke. And so I wrote, "To be fair, I was writing Java in 1992 and later compiled it to JavaScript in 1995, but it's the same basic underlying logic. That's that's just how code bases evolve sometimes. It's how XML became Xcode, for example." And he and his reply is, "Lol, okay, buddy." Like, "Oh, yeah, right, man." Like that.
Oh, that's nice.
So you used to come up to someone and say, "Check it out, I'm a giraffe."
It means you win. I think of Jen Schiffer anytime I think of stuff like that, because she always was the first person to retweet anybody that got sucked in by her any satire she wrote, and it was absolutely glorious. You know,
yeah,
that's the whole point of writing satire, is to get the person who didn't get it.
Yeah, I mean, that's trolling. I guess that's trolling to some extent. Yeah,
I know, and it's a little April Fool's Day, and not everybody appreciates that kind of thing. But when it's so over the top, XML turned into Xcode. Like, yeah. if you're taken in by that, it's just like too bad. You know?
Well, see, yeah, like some of the stuff that Jen writes is like, how can anyone possibly think that this is, you know, this is earnest? But yeah, I mean, she is absolutely the master. I think we've probably got a similar sense of humor. But this, like, trolling, and there's good trolling and there's bad trolling, I think. People will say, "Oh, you're trolling," and then to them that's always a negative thing. But I don't think it necessarily is. It's kind of like situationalist art, if it's in a good way.
Yeah.
Where you
satire is a form of criticism.
Yeah.
It is, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's trolling where you're actually harassing or bullying or kind of making light of making light of serious subjects or diverting attention away from what is an important thread or whatever. And that's just, it ranges from nuisance to, you know, borderline criminal. But then there's trolling, yeah, which is actually just kind of having fun with discourse and kind of subverting things. And I think, you know, that has its place, so long as you're not too much of a soul with it. And, you know, sometimes I cross that line, but I try not to offend people. I did do one a while ago where I, it was the Flexbox Holy Albatross thing. And I said,
yeah, this is your follow-up album to the Lobotomized Owl, which is, congratulations, and second hit. That's really hard to pull off.
Yeah. And it's always something to do with birds, and I don't know why. I don't know why it's birds. But in that article, I said, well, you can solve this kind of container query problem with JavaScript. And then I go on to say, but problem with JavaScript is that, you know, it may not run, it may be blocked, it's not as well supported because it was something to do with resize observer, and it gives you cancer. And then, so in the comments, I got a lot of people, and the thing is, I'm on the fence here, because I think what I said was maybe a bit offensive, because, well, not offensive, but kind of, could have been perhaps slightly triggering for some people because they may have been going through that, or they may know someone who's going through it. But then I thought, it's such a ubiquitous thing, cancer. It's like making jokes about death. You can say, oh, don't talk about death, because it's inevitable and it's everywhere kind of thing. So I don't know. I was kind of on the fence. But in any case, to address people's concerns, I changed it from saying JavaScript gives you cancer to saying JavaScript makes you bleed profusely from the anus. And so there, from by doing that, no, it's no longer offending people who may be suffering or dealing with cancer.
Not so widely. And I feel like if that's the case for you right now, you're probably not reading a lot of blog articles because you're more busy mopping.
Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly. I thought, yeah, it's probably a rarer condition. But also, it is—it's more factually accurate in terms of the kind of the side effects of JavaScript, anyway.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by NativeScript. NativeScript is a great way for front-end developers to start building native iOS and Android apps. You might have heard about NativeScript on Shop Talk Show before, but this time they've got some exciting news. NativeScript now officially supports Vue.js for app development. If you're a Vue developer, you can now build native mobile apps using the same framework you use on the web, while leveraging the power of NativeScript to tap into powerful mobile APIs. You can try it today at nativescript.org. And of course, they've got support for TypeScript, CSS, and popular frameworks like Angular as well. NativeScript lets you build awesome mobile apps with technologies you already know. You can start coding today with the NativeScript Playground, which is a 100% web-based resource to help you get started in minutes. And then the NativeScript CLI is there for you when you're ready to take that next step. They've got a great tutorial on their website, and then you can also get started playing with some sample apps like an animated search, a login form, music streaming app, social fitness trackers, swipeable cards and animations, charts, tab bars, restaurant menus, flight booking UIs, movie listings. There's ones that show how to build a Tinder-like swipeable card UI, putting a native dialog box in front of the user, animated rotating menus, carousels, etc. Lots and lots of stuff to check out. Be sure to visit nativescript.org to get started today. Our thanks to them for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Well, that's a fun one. Maybe we'll get to the albatross in a minute because it's fun to talk about. But I have this, just because we were talking about inclusive components and tabs and stuff, I have this one stuck in my mind. It's a fascinating article. It's almost a long read, you know, to get through that whole tabbed interface article, because there's so much stuff to consider. There's responsive design stuff, there's keyboard events, there's, I don't know, and then a whole intro of how would you start and describe them semantically and all that. And it's a lot, isn't it? It's like, and so what's been going through my mind, if I can just hijack this for a moment, is that, like, I've thought and written, and this has resonated, this concept, with people in the past, is that if there's one, like, let's say you're this designer that's, you know, has learned HTML and CSS and is having some success with that and wants to start getting into JavaScript a little bit. Maybe this isn't as applicable these days because JavaScript is so ubiquitous everywhere, but maybe 3-4 years ago, this was more, there was more people in this boat that they're like, gosh, I need to make JavaScript part of my repertoire, you know? And I was like, well, why don't you check out class list? Or if you're in jQuery land, just learn about toggle class or that. And like, have that be the one thing you learn. Learn how to query for an element and then turn a class on or off. And it's so empowering because it's, you already know HTML and CSS because you know that if you apply one class to something, it applies those styles. You take it away, those styles go away. You apply a different class, maybe the different styles on that class apply. And wow, you know, like I think something clicks in people's brain. I now have way more control over this page than I did before, especially if I can then attach that class name adding and removing to an event like a click or a tap or a scroll event or something like that. How empowering. I can learn 3 lines of JavaScript and I have this. And what that opens up, maybe for worse in my case, was that like, why would I reach for some pre-baked tab solution when I can do it myself? I can make 3 anchor links and I'm a semantic knowing type of dude. I know how to do this right. I'm going to make those anchor links point to a hash link to a div further down or a section further down that has a matching ID so that these are links that point to the right place. Go me. Well, I've done it. I've made these semantically perfect now. So 3 anchor links, and then I'm going to display none, all of them. And, you know, and then when you click one of them, it can find the appropriate thing and apply a class like active. An active will display block the correct one. And now I've made tabs. I've made them semantically perfect and done. I can, you know, like, look at me. I write 3 lines of JavaScript. Only to find out later that, like, holy crap, that was, you know, there's no correct ARIA roles being used here. I didn't think about keyboard events at all. There's like a million things I forgot about. I felt empowered. I felt like I was doing it correct, only to learn, you know, years later, I was almost doing the world a disservice in a way because I didn't think about the, you know, the 10 other things that tabs had to do here. So I don't have a point with all that, but maybe my point is read Hayden's article here about tabbed interfaces.
Well, no. I want to stop you there because first of all, you've done a lot of good things for the world. I think we can agree on that. And second of all, it's kind of actually really, I'm really ambivalent about tabs and I'm really ambivalent about the ARIA in tabs, to be honest. So in my version of it, the inclusive components version of it, it does the ARIA stuff, but it kind of, there's a couple of little hacks I put in there as well, because the ARIA stuff doesn't actually play particularly well sometimes with some types of screen reader and screen reader mode. I'm really like, if I was building an interface and I had control over how, you know, how the information is laid out and what's hidden and what's not hidden and what's interactive, I probably would avoid tabs altogether. But just recently, and this is since I wrote that article and then later wrote the book, and the book is kind of like the articles but updated, I started doing some work with the BBC in the UK, and they had their own tab interface, which was kind of set out in terms of this is how it should work, but it was set out at a very high level. There was no advice in terms of how to code it. And I thought, okay, I can do the ARIA thing. And you know, do the arrow keyboard events as well. So you go onto a tab and you use your arrows to switch between the tabs rather than the tab key, etc. And then we went back and forth about this a little bit, and there was some prior research. I mean, the BBC being a really huge organization, they're able to do lots of research, and we just weren't confident that that was actually the right way to do it, despite the fact that it was considered the kind of canonical version where you have the ARIA and the arrow navigation, etc. So we actually, I made 3 different versions of the tab interface. One which, and I think it is a legitimate way of doing it, which is like you described, Chris, which is the actually they're kind of same page anchor links, which link up to the different panels. And the only way it's really different from just like linking to different sections in the page is that it, it shows and hides the panels. So one version was kind of like that, no ARIA stuff, no like custom key bindings or anything like that. One was like the full ARIA thing, as kind of set out by the ARIA design practices, whatever that document it is, where it tells you how to do your ARIA kind of ARIA and interaction stuff. And then one which was kind of a compromise position where it didn't do the arrow key navigation, but it did have the semantics there. And so, yeah, it was somewhere in between. And we did like 2 full days of watching different keyboard users. So we're all keyboard users, obviously, but I mean people who depends more on the keyboard, people who can't or would prefer not to use a touchpad or a mouse. And they all completely disagreed over which one they preferred. There are some difficulties in some places. So like lots of people just didn't find the arrow keys. So that was kind of a red flag. So it's kind of an ergonomic way to interact with something. But as it turns out, even though that's kind of a familiar pattern for a like a native application, like a Windows application where there's tabs, you're kind of used to doing that there. People don't expect that in a web page. They expect it to be much more simple. They expect it to be basically headings and links. And so they didn't know it was there. At least a couple of the participants just didn't find it. So they never actually made it to the other tabs because they didn't even know they were present, or at least the partially sighted or blind users in any case, because they couldn't see them either. So as it turns out, the kind of save page link version of it, the idea was when you clicked on a tab, it would also send focus to the panel, which is a big no-no in terms of the official ARIA pattern. The idea is that you're supposed to...
Is it really?
Yes.
You just make it appear, you don't actually send focus there.
Exactly. So the idea is that because you've designated the arrow keys for selecting tabs, the tab key then becomes... or tab and shift tab becomes your way of directly going from the active tab into the panel and back. So it's ergonomic as long as you know that that's how it behaves and you know what a tab is. I mean, one of the participants spent the whole time going, oh, tags, yeah, I get it, tags, yeah, okay. And then at the end we said, this is as you do in these sorts of sessions, obviously it's not their fault, but they were saying tags, they thought we were talking about tags, they thought the interface was a tag interface with a G. So, I mean, that's one of the great things about research is you think you're going to find out some of the creases that you have to iron out with your interfaces. But actually what you end up finding out is ultimately that everyone does things totally differently, understands things totally differently. Everyone is completely disparate. And the only hope you have all of making
actual testing
is finding out that is ensuring that things are so simple that it's difficult to make critical errors. And so it turned out in this case, it was this compromise version was quite good because it was, they kind of got the tab or even if they thought it was tag metaphor, but they preferred to have their focus moved for them because otherwise the arrow keys wouldn't be found and, it seemed to be a one tab interface kind of thing. So in the book version of the blog, I've updated this and there's like, I've stuffed that chapter full of caveats and do research with your users and see how they interact with it, try it out in context, et cetera, et cetera. But I would, honestly, if I was going to do any kind of open, close, show and hide thing, I would probably use something much more like an accordion because it's just the interaction is simpler. You go to a heading or like a handle, you click it, and then the next thing in focus, the next thing in the source is there. Yeah, exactly. Much easier to make responsive as well. A tab interface isn't a tab interface if the tabs like are on top of each other, right? That's not how filing cabinets work. That would be weird. So, yeah.
That's a good point. I have a friend, Dan, who works at Texas School for the Blind and Visually Impaired here in Austin, Texas. And, he actually is in charge of like procuring technologies for kids and, you know, oh, we want to use like Google Apps. Like, okay, let's run it through all the tests, you know, like see if our kids can even use it, you know? And it's, so it's, he's doing really cool work, but you know, one thing that he's like kind of illuminated to me is like, even these kids and I think just screen readers in general, you know, are just people, in that there's even different levels of technical proficiency, you know, among people, and same among screen reader users. And so, you know, not everyone uses it the same, and not everyone, you know, is super savvy. Like, oh, that was a tab. Like, oh, okay. I didn't know I could open that. You know, like these are things you see. I mean, we are web developers, so I sort of assume like we are very experienced with tabs, but you know, if you have ever like watched a screen share on somebody from your client or office doing a PowerPoint or something, it's like painful to watch, right? Like,
but yeah. Well,
you're just like, click that thing.
Very difficult not to help, isn't it? Because your natural instinct is to help and tell them how to do it. It's kind of like a Columbo thing where he does that trick where he kind of gets them to admit their guilt by kind of like telling them to, you know, oh, so you did it like this, and then eventually they go, no, I did it in a much more clever way or whatever. It's that kind of instinct to get involved, isn't it? But you're absolutely right, Dave. We started using terms like, we would say, I mean, I guess most businesses, when they do research, they talk about power users and non-power users. We ended up, I mean, that intersects with every kind of different way of doing things as well. So you have power keyboard users and power screen reader users and non-power keyboard or screen reader users. And we found that, yeah, the non-power screen reader users, they can navigate between headings. They can use their up and down arrow keys to go like paragraph to paragraph or just element to element. And they'll use their tab key to focus interactive elements. But they will know little more than that, maybe, in terms of what's on offer from the screen reader. And there is an awful lot on offer from the screen reader. Obviously, you can do all sorts of different kind of interactions and shortcuts with most of the main screen reader software. And then, yeah, you had people who, I know what a tab interface is, but usually they would be someone who is in somewhere or another technical or a developer or something like that themselves, because of course, being in accessibility like myself, you will meet people like that who are screen reader users, who then know how screen readers work, because they're kind of more involved and they understand the underlying technology a lot more too. And because they're close to us, obviously we take a lot of advice for them, and it's still valuable advice because it helps us to understand how these things work. But at the same time, you have to accept that most people are not as savvy as us in terms of how the web works in general, but then there are non-savvy screen reader users as well, for instance. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. You don't often think of somebody that they use a screen reader and aren't particularly good at it.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to factor that in, or even like braille readers, like, I think all of us can be like, yeah, I know what a web page reading, you know, like a web page being read to me is like. I can kind of close my eyes and imagine that. But you think about a braille reader where it just presents like, there's like 8 piano keys and then a little dynamic braille input, but that just prints out one line of text at a time across the page, you know?
That's, like, yeah, like, that's a whole other paradigm.
That's different, yeah. Right? Like, I have no kind of frame of reference for it. And so it's.
Or then you get like a switch accessibility where it's literally just one button, which, you know, you can use to do various interactions, mm-hmm. But that's, you know, it's like this really minimalist way of interacting with something. And yeah, it's a difficult thing to get your head around. But like, we're going back to what we were saying before, but that's what makes it interesting, I think. And I think also what we're kind of stumbling upon a little bit is this difference between what's accessibility and what's inclusive design. And I've tried to kind of try and pinpoint that on several occasions. And I think the idea that, so making something work with a screen reader is in so that technically, in terms of, you know, I suppose in the terms of like the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines and WCAG, it's not broken, like it's not communicating information to a screen reader is one thing. That's kind of making it accessible. It technically isn't not doing what it should. But then that's that technical element is one thing, but then you have to think, well, is it actually intuitive? Would you expect this thing, which is being communicated correctly to a screen reader, to even be here? And if it is there, should it be next to this other thing? Does it make sense in the context of the page? Is the behavior of it expected for what else is going on? And all of those kinds of concerns. And they're much more to... that's much more the kind of broader, woollier, more tacit, inclusive design thing about actually how people think about things and trying to make it as intuitive and simple as possible.
Think about people who get things locked in their head, because it feels like this is happening to me all the time throughout my career. Now there's some canonical resource for something like a tabbed interface, or maybe you hope that it's not that, but you know, I think people reference inclusive components for that. Like, just give me the pattern. I want the pattern, you know, even though if you tell them to their face, please do the testing, you know, that's what really matters. Or and it's not the only one out there. You know, there's other resources that kind of tell you how you should do something. People like to be told what to do.
Well, wasn't Scott O'Hara was just posted like the dialogue element isn't actually really accessible at all.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Scott's really good at drilling into the kind of the technical shortcomings of some of these things and finding really good workarounds. He's really good at finding those things and covering them.
There's got to be a balance though between that nuance of like I don't know, don't get any particular pattern locked into your mind as the perfect pattern for this, because it never is one, and that everything is complicated to the point like, well, but don't use that as an excuse to not do to try to do a good job, because there is no right answer. There's still lots of wrong answers, you know?
Absolutely.
I think of things that get locked in people's mind. Like there was this Liza Danger article a long time ago that was like, don't use M's for media queries because there's a bug in how browsers handle pixels for media queries. And it was it's my canonical example of this, because it was so perfectly written and explained that it just locked into the developer consciousness that you are not allowed to use M's for media queries. Or maybe was it the other way around? It was don't use pixels. Oh, now apparently it has faded from.
I think that, there was a bug. I think it was REMS actually, but it was, there was just kind of some offset issue thing. I remember the one you mean. Yeah.
It had to do with zooming or whatever, but it turns out that like that was a lot of years ago, and that problem is totally gone, and you don't need to worry about that anymore. But still, if you use one in an example, you'll get a comment that says, "Don't you know? You're not allowed to do that." You know, which I think of, you know, you post a blog post that uses some pattern that is against something that's locked in people's mind that you're not allowed to do. It's just funny that you'll get called out on it without any of the nuance. It's just like, nope, you've used the wrong pattern. Boop, alarm.
Yeah, there was actually, because I know this is one of your favorite subjects, Chris, is the SVG. There was a really, there was a thing that came up on Twitter. Someone was sharing this thing, and it was like a photograph of their folder of images, like their icons. And they're all in SVG, but they all had like the, 200x200.svg and then 192x192.
This is the size of this particular SVG.
Yeah. And I got into conversation with these people in this thread, and they were absolutely adamant that there is a pixel grid, a universal pixel grid, which regardless of whether you're using a SVG or using a raster graphic, you have to line it up onto that pixel grid. So you have to have special dimensions for these things, regardless of the fact that SVG is vectors and, as you perfectly well know, scales automatically. They were still, and I said, no, that it's the S stands for scalable. And they're like, yeah, I know that it is scalable, but it still has to fit with the pixel grid. But I think it was Terence Eden wrote a little while ago, which was brilliant article, and it was basically there's no such thing as a universal pixel grid, and he talks about all the different screen pixel geometries, and they're not even square. like like a raster will be sort of divided into square blocks, won't it? And in JPEG, they're kind of like groups or whatever. And
not that I forgive anybody necessarily, but I think there is a concept of not lining things to a pixel grid. Like in Photoshop, you can accidentally make a vector in between two pixel lines and it ends up kind of blurry or whatever. But that's a kind of an origin image problem, not a... it doesn't translate to the web.
No, exactly. Yeah. But they will go on probably for 3 or 4 years or the rest of their lives believing this is a thing. And this is going back to what we were saying before about this
locks into your mind.
This fundamental problem we have as a species, which once we've decided something, we're too embarrassed to then go back and say, do you know what, I was wrong. Because
are you making a Brexit analogy again?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. So then we do this double down thing, don't we? Where I'm going to be even more committed to the idea of this fantastical universal pixel grid, despite the fact that different
screens. I like that you brought up the double down. The double down is really a plague, isn't it? And I totally am susceptible to it. But you and not, I'm
nope,
not,
it's great. I'm sticking to it.
I know. It makes me even more convicted. It's so wild. It's such a thing.
I'm really bad with
I'm
that
sure
as well.
I have it too.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I know. You question me? You questioning me? Oh, you better not. Anyway.
Yeah.
Sarah Drasner was saying, I can't even remember the context, but she was talking about SVG in that way too, and she was talking about the scalability of them, and she was be like, yes, scale, it's the first word in the acronym, come on. And people were like, Sarah, nobody knows that. I'm like, how do you, what? I feel like that was the number one talking point of SVG always. I don't think I've ever read a blog post that didn't start with something about SVG that didn't talk about the scale.
Well, I saw your talk. I forget which one. It was one about SVG, obviously, and you did a good bit at the start. Was like, okay, before we get into all of the kind of like other neat stuff about SVG. First of all, it's scalable. That's fantastic. Like that solves so many problems in so many.
Right. If that's the one thing it did, it would be cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Even if you didn't have all the other, the filters and all of that stuff. But like, I actually call SVG Sarah Vector Graphics a lot because you've got because Sarah's like a real sort of SVG maven, as in Sarah Drasner. But then you've also got Sarah Sweden as well. So it's like it seems that all of the Sarahs, anyone called Sarah is just really good at SVG. So
yeah. I always think of Amelia too. It's being encyclopedically about all the niche stuff too. So I know, like, I have a book about SVG. I feel confident in my ability to like use the basics of SVG. Maybe only slightly above average of your average front end developers. These days, it has fortunately kind of seeped into most people's toolkits, thank God. But for the most part, feel almost helpless when it comes to complicated, nuanced stuff with SVG. I am not an expert in the way that somebody like Amelia is, who I know firsthand because I've hired her to do interesting little things. Like, I know this is possible. I know it. They're like the stuff that gets me is like when you kind of nest SVGs and you're like, I want this part up here to be scalable in this way where it like stretches horizontally but not vertically. And I want this little piece over here to not stretch at all because it's like a corner or something. And this piece to stretch vertically and all that interesting stuff. And she'll be like, here's 7 ways to do it. You know, I'll be like, what?
I think we can agree that all of the A's in scalable vector graphics should probably stand for Amelia, given her prodigious knowledge of SVG. Yeah. She's like Steve Faulkner with accessibility. Like, there is nothing that they couldn't really tell you. If you wanted to know something and you ask them and obviously try not to bother either of them too much, but they will know, and you'll be like, oh, okay, cool, thank you.
We're kind of going over time here. I hope that's okay, but we just wanted to like wrap up like with some accessibility. Like the recent WebAIM Million came out and it's kind of shocking study where like 98% of all websites are inaccessible, and through even like automated detection, like running it through Lighthouse and finding an error. I just wanted to get your thoughts. Like, how do we break out of that jam? And is it a fault of Aria? Is it Aria's fault? Is it too hard to make an accessible website, or is it developer's fault? Is it just, are we failing? You know,
yeah.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
That's a really good question, though. So I think one of the things that to just touch on the Aria thing, one of the things I think it found, if I recall correctly, is that the more Aria was detected on the page, the more likely it was to be inaccessible, which is kind of...
Yeah, like in inverse...
I know, you hate to read that though, right? Because then you're like, the easy takeaway from that is like, oh, good, screw that. I'll never use one again then. Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a kind of an anecdote about this, which kind of told me a lot about, I think, the way that developers approach things. And it's kind of a nice story because I think there's a lot of good intention. There's obviously people who don't care about accessibility enough to learn about it. And it's kind of written off as, like CSS, it's written off as one of these things where it's so difficult. But it's only difficult because you haven't learned it. Like, I've spent ages, like a year, like more than a decade writing CSS, and I still find aspects of it difficult. But the same with JavaScript or anything like that. I mean, JavaScript I find much harder.
Accessibility has become sort of second nature. I mean, I feel that too. It's like, oh, I can't use pink text on white.
Yeah.
My life is over. But now oh yeah, of course you can't. You
know? Yeah. Someone pointed the whole gray text on white thing is kind of funny. Cause it's like, yeah, it's technically inaccessible, but also it just looks bad. It looks, you know, yeah. So the specific instance that I remember was when I was working, consulting a company in the UK. And so this was one of those situations where I come in, I'm the accessibility consultant, I test everything, find out what's wrong with everything, and come up with some ideas about how to improve it, etc. And for my own sort of mental health, I tend to only work with clients who I know are committed to accessibility. Like, trying to beat people around the head with it who don't care about it, I guess I just will those companies to just fail in general. So, you know, I mean, one of the expressions I like to use is that not everything should be accessible. Some things just shouldn't exist at all. So anything that exists should be accessible, should be inclusive of as many people as it can be. But some things should just go away. And if the company culture is so horrible, the product's going to be horrible, it's bound to be inaccessible. I just want it to die, basically. So I only work with organizations who are generally trying or want to try about this stuff. But this organization was one of those organizations. They really cared about it. They really listened to me. But one of the early mistakes I found was an Aria mistake. And it was, it had completely destroyed the whole application for someone, specifically for someone who uses a voiceover screen reader, you know, the Mac screen reader. This is something that I discovered fairly, I didn't realize that was the outcome of it, but I saw that the Aria was misplaced. And it was just written up as one of those things we have to solve, put it in a ticket, put it in Jira, whatever. And then a few weeks later, this came up again, because we got a kind of a complaint, I suppose. It was quite politely worded, but this person wrote to the organization and said, as I explained, this is not working for me at all. I'm a voiceover user. I cannot use your website whatsoever because I'm a voiceover user. Is there anything you can do? And we were like, well, what do you actually experience? What's the problem? And they said, the whole page is just being read out as just one piece of text. There's no structure. I can't find headings or lists or anything like that. And I suddenly recalled this thing that I discovered. And what it was React has this switch component that kind of wraps the roots. I don't know if the latest version of React has this, but in any case, there was this switch thing. You put all your roots inside it, and it's kind of like the wrapper for the roots, and it helps you switch between them, I guess. And someone had thought, let's make this accessible. Done a sort of cursory glance of some, Aria, and discovered role equals switch. And role equals switch turns the element that it's on into a button. So this thing, which was like the wrapper for the whole page, like the whole application, had been told to communicate itself
via button
to the browser. Yeah, to the browser and therefore to the assistive technology, to the screen reader, as a button. And so, yeah, the experience they're explaining then suddenly made sense. So they're encountering this thing. And as soon as you tell something it's a button, it can't have kind of structured content inside it. Everything gets like flattened into just being a label. And at that point, I was being asked to kind of motivate the team, because I was going to leave as someone who was working with them. I was trying to motivate them to kind of carry the torch of accessibility after I'd left. And so I was able to come up to one of the developers and say, okay, no matter what else we do today, in the next 3 or 4 minutes, we're going to make this this application 100% more accessible for at least one person. And we just removed role equals switch. And it's kind of funny because it then went through this very complicated, verification, testing process or anything. I knew damn well that removing that thing would have no adverse effect. It would only make this one person or any voiceover user's life better. And then
is this purely like an ARIA role? You're not changing HTML, you're not changing CSS, you're not changing JavaScript. It was
exactly
just an attribute.
And a lot of the problems that come with ARIA, and it's probably why it was such a big thing in WebAIM's study, is that it quite often, or in most cases, it changes the semantics. It changes the way things are communicated without changing the way they behave necessarily. Or there's a mismatch between the two things. But in this case, it actually, in VoiceOver, with VoiceOver running, actually kind of made it behave like a button. Like clicking it wouldn't do anything, but it was sort of, it did treat the page's content like a label. But the cool thing was that we did that little thing and then we forgot about it. But then the next day, the person wrote in, because I'd sneakily pushed this to master knowing that it wouldn't kind of break anything, which was a bit cheeky. I kind of like jumped the queue a bit, but I just wanted to make this happen so that I could go back to the developer and go, look what we did. And they wrote back to us and they were just really surprised at how quickly we turned this application into something which was total shit and they couldn't use at all, into something which was actually perfectly okay. Within like a day, like they'd gone to bed and gone up and suddenly they could use the words.
I mean, I guess the moral of the story is one ARIA role can just sink a ship.
Exactly.
So just be careful.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's a very powerful tool, but actually in a lot of cases, I mean, just for efficiency's sake, you want to use native elements. So if you've got a div and you put role equals button on it, it will appear as a button, but then you need to make it focusable by having tab index equals 0. And then you need to actually bind keyboard events so that when you use the keyboard, you can click it and so on. You know, it doesn't support the disabled attribute out of the box. You'd have to do that with ARIA too, and make it not focusable whilst it's in the disabled state. And it goes on and on and on. You could just use a button element and it's going to be more efficient as well as more robust. And you get user agent styles as well. If you
That's a great one. There's a reason that one is such a classic, is because it's just one element and it tells such a complex story. And then it's like, well, if the story is that complex just for button versus div, imagine a whole interface, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I do think it's really sad, the state of things, but it's kind of, it's this tension between, one of the great things about the web is that you don't have to do things in a specific way. You can be creative and you can be experimental and you can kind of put your own mark on things. But in order for that to be possible, the code has to be very forgiving, doesn't it? Like you can mess up your CSS and most of it will still pass, or you can mess up your HTML and it's not going to just not like load because there's a bit which is arguably inaccessible or whatever. But unfortunately, that also means that it's kind of the Wild West as well, isn't it? So
I just finally read Bruce Lawson's The Practical Value of Semantic HTML, where he kind of talks about like, why would we do this? You know, he's HTML5 doctor, like he's, you know, he's been doing this a while. And he also calls it an old fart's guide to like HTML or something like that. Dull old web fart guide. But it was neat. You know, it just was like, you know, I think around forms is particularly like, you know, like that's the most obvious sell. Like, oh, shoot, like my form now works on an Apple Watch. Like, and I did nothing, you know, that's cool tech. Or like, but then you get into the article element, like that formats it into a reader view. You get into the header and footer that like people can skip those or navigate to those on a, you know, or the main element can navigate to those using their rotor in a screen reader. You know, there's so many unknowns about semantic HTML. It's yeah. Anyway, we should probably wrap this up. We're getting very late. So
we'll, yes, I'm we'll sorry
have to, part to this.
It's, if I haven't talked about the Vanilla Ice film, then
well, yeah, like, we may have to cut that out now. But no, if we did, and we didn't even get to talk about the Holy Albatross, which solves layout on the web. So we'll talk. We'll have to figure that out. But Hayden, thank you so much for coming on the show. For people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Oh, well, I was the Inclusive Components was funded by some generous people whilst it was a blog, and then I gave the book free to them. I don't actually have anything for sale at the moment. That's all kind of done. I didn't really need money. Give it to charity instead. Support a progressive campaigning organization. Support your trans brothers and sisters. Give them some money.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month.
You know, Shop Talk has a job board, right? ShopTalkShow.com/jobs, which is full of jobs of, you know, about the stuff that we talk about on the show a lot, web design and development. There's one job on there that we want to tell you about in particular. There'll be a link to this job posting as part of this show, of course. And it's for a senior interaction designer in Chicago, Illinois, at a place called Talk. Their URL is exploretalk.com, which is worth checking out just anyway, because it's kind of an amazing little app that they're building. And it's like a restaurant management app, which I feel like all of us, even just if we just go to restaurants sometimes, we can see how kind of bad that is sometimes at so many different restaurants. Anyway, the story is, you know, these guys, they open this restaurant, incredible, 3 Michelin stars in Chicago. They have dedicated staff just dealing with reservations, and they lose some hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on cancellations specifically. So anyway, the guy goes on to found with some Google guy this company Talk that is, you know, blowing up and people are loving it and has, you know, winning awards for industry innovation and stuff. And it just looks fantastic. It looks like, oh gosh, thank God somebody's tackling these problems at dealing with all the different stuff at restaurants, which is, you know, not only reservation management, but dealing with your tables and communicating with your customers and all kinds of stuff like that. So I can't, you know, they'll do a better job at describing it, but you should go check out the site just because it's interesting software anyway. But they need somebody who's an HTML, CSS, and JavaScript person, you know, because they're building in React, but I like that they mentioned React last. You know, they want your HTML, CSS, and JavaScript skills. And, you know, you're comfortable reviewing code and getting code to production, and you care and empathize with users, and you care about metrics and data, and you know, understand business constraints and all those, that type of stuff. Of course you do already, because you listen to this show. It makes you good at those things, darn it. Check it out, you know, go work with them in Chicago. It looks like they have a wonderful place to work, and it's a darn good job.
And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
JobTalkShow.com.